Hi everyone, my name is Simran Bhatia and I am a staff writer for The Profile. Today I had an amazing opportunity to interview Martin Webb. He is a director, filmmaker, and documentarian based out of the UK, and he is most known for his work on the first four seasons of Formula One Drive to Survive on Netflix, as well as Netflix's latest docuseries called Breakpoint, which follows world tennis champions as they play across the globe. I learned so much from this conversation with Martin, and he gave a lot of cool insights into what it takes to film Formula One as well as pro tennis across the world, weekend after weekend. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation with Martin as much as I did, and as always, subscribe to The Profile to read and hear more, and let us know who you think we should interview next. Hope you enjoy. Thank you so much for joining us today, Martin. Really appreciate your time. We were actually just chatting about, you know, your aspirations to go become a pro football player. And around the age of 15 or 16, you said that that was sort of your wake-up call, that maybe that wasn't going to be the right career path for you. So I wanted to ask, is that sort of what catapulted you into picking up a camera? Is that around the time at which you, you know, wanted to start exploring the career of a filmmaker?
The one kind of area that I really enjoyed was media studies. You know, it kind of came into the sort of national curriculum around that time when I was kind of 15, 16. And, you know, you had the option to choose that subject. I chose it. I really enjoyed it. I kind of thought it was just helping us understand like culture and who we were, who we are, why things are the way they are. We were, you know, allowed to use cameras and we were allowed to shoot little films. And I think I was kind of obsessed with films already at that point. So it was the thing that of all of the studies, it was the thing that excited me the most, I think. And so it was just a natural extension of that, really, was to kind of keep following it. And so I went to university after school, went to kind of like a media university, studied television and film. I kind of actually wish I hadn't. Kind of wish I'd studied maybe something else, because I'm literally trained for nothing else. Like, this is it. This is what I. This is
what do you
I do
wish you that, studied?
And that's it. I don't know. I kind of think I could have even something just about, you know, history or you know, maybe philosophy or politics, or I think something that just would have been innately had more sort of reading in it. But look, no real regrets, you know, like, but I remember coming out of university and really got a pretty good degree, but, you know, no one cared. it's pretty hard to get a job in TV or film, especially if you're not connect, you know, unless your parents are kind of from that world or from that space, or you have family that have done very well in it. It does feel like a bit of a closed club, I think. And there was, you know, there was 6 months after leaving university where I really thought this isn't going to work. Like, I mean, honestly, I wasn't even getting a no. I wasn't even getting no's from people. And it's really challenging. And I think it still is for people. I mean, I think the pathways to getting into it and making it pay, making it sustainable, are really, really thin. And they're different for everybody. You've probably got a story, I've got a story, someone else has got one, and, you know, we're making it work, but it's fragile.
Was this a nourished passion of yours when you decided that this was something you wanted to pursue? Like, did people in your support system, your family, did they encourage you to go after this? Or was this sort of like, this is your passion, you don't care what anybody else says, like, you want to go for it kind of deal?
I think it's a bit of both, really. I think they would have, you know, look, I've got two good parents and, you know, they support you in anything that you want to do, but it's not something that they understood really, especially if you come from a kind of, I would say, like, you know, a kind of industrialized mindset, you know, part of the world where it's about 9 to 5, it's about, you know, a proper job sort of mentality. I think there is this perception that, you know, it's a bit of a non-job, you know, TV and film and media studies. And
so
and I think that even if people are not saying that to you, I think it's something that you just feel, you know, as you're doing it, and you wonder to yourself a little bit, well, maybe I do need to go and get a proper job at some point.
Definitely.
And it takes a while to actually, you have to stick at it, and you know, you need to have some wins, you need to have some successes, you need to make a bit of money, you need to get noticed, and you need to mature, like, and you need to grow up, and you need to, as I think it's the, in this profession, you get better at it as you get older, because it's so much of it is to do with about, I think, who you are and like how you feel about yourself and, you know, the world around you. But hey, look, my dad's bailed me out of, you know, Civil War type scenarios and bought me tickets out of Liberia and picked me up from airports and you know, sent me money for this, that and the other. And yeah, they've been supportive in the way that they know. So this is a profession that's not in the webs, you know, it's not been part of the web family tree at all.
Yeah, you broke away.
I think so.
You actually mentioned something interesting about how you become a better sort of filmmaker the older you get. And so you've had several titles across your career so far, like cinematographer, director, editor, producer. What part of being a filmmaker is most enjoyable to you and why?
I think you get to use all of yourself, you know, especially in documentary, the you know, the types of films I make, it's a very physical job, so you need to be fit and strong. You're carrying equipment around, you're moving these boxes around the world, literally moving boxes around the world a lot of the time. You need to be, you know, you're switching skill sets all the time, you know, when the camera's out, you know, you need to have all of that technical understanding of the equipment that you're using. You need to be able to connect with the people that you're working with. You know, you need to be able to, you need to be sensitive to everything that's happening in front of you. You need to be a good watcher. You need to be a real listener. You know, so much of filmmaking is just about listening.
Yeah.
It really is. And observing and, I think you need to be, I'm working on these slightly bigger projects now. So I actually have a team of directors working with me. So that's a kind of a new skill set in a way. It's thinking about how to resource, you know, different shoots at the same time, how to move people around. There's, you know, there's budgets come into it. This is kind of where the commerce meets the art. So I think I enjoy using a lot of myself, and I think it's the ultimate sort of present tense job as well. You're there to capture the moments of other people, and to do that you need to be completely in tune with what's happening right there and right, you know, and now, otherwise you're going to miss it. So
you know, a big part of what you do is being right there in the moment to be able to document it and get the full picture of, you know, what's going on. So for example, you know, Formula One and tennis, competitive tennis, the season schedule is crazy. It's all over the world, nonstop. So it's a different country every weekend in most cases. Mm-hmm. So what does it take to organize your film crew and your directors and everyone to capture all of those moments on camera as it's happening?
Wow, where to begin? I mean, they're two different sports, right? So like I was working in Formula One for sort of 4 years, really. I did the first four seasons. The first two seasons as like a director and then as a series director, the second two. I mean, let's park that for a minute, because tennis, I've just started making tennis and it is difficult. It is really difficult. You have, it's like these moving targets all the time. Yeah. So you have a bunch of individual players, individual characters. The cast is a bunch of individuals. So they don't belong to a team. And there's probably 80 tournaments happening throughout the year, you know, and we're never quite sure which tournaments our characters are going to be going to. You can kind of make an educated guess because there are bigger tournaments, there are smaller tournaments, but we don't actually know when they're going to arrive at those tournaments because that their arrival date depends on how they got on in the tournament before that one. So it presents this huge challenge of scheduling, resourcing, guesswork, really. Like, okay, we know that tournament is important to that character. They've told us they're going to be there, but they're playing in Acapulco 3 days before. And, you know, they're saying that, oh, they're not going to do too well in that. And all of a sudden they're in the final. Well, do you send, you know, seven people to Acapulco to get the end of that tournament? Or do you send those seven people to, you know, Palm Springs, which is where that player's going to be 3 days later? Or maybe they'll be there a week later or a week before, you know? And yeah. So it's really tricky, and there isn't a kind of a magic solution to that. It's a lot of conversation within the team. And I think tennis is really difficult. That's probably the toughest part for me about tennis. Formula One, you have 22 races in a year. You know exactly where they are, you know, and also you know that everyone's going to be there. It's a kind of a unique sport in a way, and probably why that show works. One of the reasons why that show works so well, it's like I know that all of those 20 characters are going to be within, you know, 100 meters of each other. They're all going to be there in Singapore in 3 days' time. They're going to arrive on Thursday. They're going to leave on Sunday. And then a week later, I know they're all going to be in Brazil.
Yeah.
You know, so you can work, you know, you can then actually do the job that you're actually hired to do, which is make the films, tell the stories, you know, establish the relationships, you know, and shoot compelling stuff. Well, in tennis, there is all this other work and we're getting better at it, you know, and I think we did pretty well actually in season one, but there's this other sort of scheduling logistical work that is profound. It's really difficult.
I can imagine. That sounds like a logistical nightmare, to be honest.
It is. As the show grows and as the relationships get stronger with the characters, you get closer, I think trust, you know, builds, trust kind of increases. They tell you more, and
yeah,
you know, they can be a bit more, you can be a bit more concrete about making plans.
That actually, you know, brings me into another question I had about, you know, there in the first few seasons of Formula One, you can see that there's some drivers, there's some team principals that aren't very comfortable on camera or speaking. And then you see them evolve over the course of time. Like, I think Max is probably one of those in the seasons, over the course of the few seasons, he's gotten a lot more comfortable being interviewed and opening up. So what do you do in the case of building trust with these people who are professionals in their sport? And let's just say they don't want to open up, or you want to get them to open up. What are strategies that you use to get your subject comfortable? And especially since they're so critical to the story and the narrative that you're telling.
You know, without trust, there's no intimacy. With no intimacy, you're not really getting, you're not really telling the story of who people really are, you know. And if we're not doing that, then we might as well go. I think so. Trust is the key currency for like documentary filmmakers. I'm sure, you know, they'll all say something similar. And it's a process. It's a kind of and you know, sometimes it's a daily process, an hourly process of conversation, of talking to people, of explaining, you know, what this is and why it's important that you're there. And it's, you know, there is a sliding scale. Like some people are all in straight away, and some people give you a little bit, and then they give you another little bit and another little bit. And then eventually they give you a bit more. And, you know, 2 years later, all of a sudden you're at their wedding. You know, I think you can't betray that trust as well. You know, if you let them down, if it's not what they thought, then they probably won't come back. I mean, look, I think Formula One was interesting. We did season one when it first came out. No one would talk to us. We walked back into the paddock for season two, and everybody in the show was like, what the hell is this? You know, they kind of weren't aware of how they looked, and quite what it looked like. And basically the rest of the world loved it, you know? And so gradually they were like, oh, okay, we get this now, you know? And gradually more and more people came on board. But I think the trust thing, look, it's a conversation, you know? And as you see in the show, there's, you know, there's people that probably would never normally be filmed. There's billionaires in the show, you know? I mean, who gets access to billionaires? And I think we try and work a bit differently to, there's a hell of a lot of media in Formula One. There's a hell of a lot of cameras like already there. We try and just work a little bit differently to those guys because we're not in the live environment. It means we have more time. It doesn't take from the contributors. You never want to be taking from them. You never want to be drawing any energy from them. You never want to get in the way of, you know, the last thing you can do in when you're working with these elite athletes is get in the way of performance.
Are you allowed to share who in the show was your favorite to work with?
The major work was Christian Horner.
Yeah.
Me. Like he's my guy. You know? He's my guy.
I think he's grown to really enjoy you know, the show's presence in the paddock. I think he uses it as an outlet for whatever is going on in real life with the show.
He's an amazing, you know, TV character. I mean, he's actually a lovely guy as well. You know, like no matter what you think about the man in the show, the man himself is a real sweetheart, you know, and he was the first team principal to let us in, you know, episode one, season one. And look, that first Grand Prix we did in Australia, like we had no idea what we were doing. I mean, we got thrown into this project with a company that, they'd made Senna, right? They made Senna, they made Amy, they'd made these huge feature-length documentaries that we were all completely deferential towards, but they'd never really made a TV show. So a few of us were brought in to kind of make this TV show with them. As I say, I got lost, you know, I got lost at that first Grand Prix, like this huge festival site. Like I remember being dragged around just thinking, what on earth are we doing? Like, how are we going to make this? You know, this is a world that has never been filmed before. No one's really, they don't really want us here. They're not really, there's huge amounts of secrecy everywhere, intellectual property problems, you know, the whole kind of sport is in transition. But Christian was the first team principal to put on a radio mic. He was the first one to do it. At that first event, and he was the first one to let, you know, one of us into his garage with a camera. You know, you have to respect that. Because, you know, now most of them will do that, but someone needed to be first, you know. And then and then when in season four, you know, the final race in Abu Dhabi, when, you know, that final lap where Max kind of won it, do you remember, did you see that? You mm-hmm. saw that one, yeah.
Yeah. I watched all of it religiously the day it comes out. So
well, I basically, you know, do everything with Red Bull pretty much. And I remember being, you know, beneath the pit wall on those last few laps. And I had a GoPro looking at Christian, because you can't get around this. There's a GoPro looking at him, and I'm behind him with my camera. He's got the radio mic on, he's had it on all day. And I just, you know, when Max won that race, say what you want about whether it was right or wrong or whatever, but for me, as a moment, as a rewarding moment, with a contributor, you know, Christian turns around, it just, the emotion just overcomes him completely.
Yeah,
you know, tears to win it in that way. And I just, yeah, like I felt like as a, you know, documentary filmmaker, TV director, whatever you want to call it, like that's probably as good as it gets for me, you know, to have a moment like that with a relationship that I started 4 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, that began 4 years ago, to have it. And this is this guy, right, who's been telling me since then that he's going to win it, that he's going to do it. Stick around. This year I'm going to do it. No, no, no. This year I'm going to do it. No, no, no. This year, really, I'm going to do it. And we would sit down every year and I'd be like, really? You really going to do it? And you know, to see him do it, to see Max do it and Christian do it in that way was, because that was probably the most watched moment on the planet in that moment, you know.
Yeah.
But to have it kind of a deeply personal moment, that is also a kind of international moment, I just felt very lucky, you know, because you can do these things for a long time and that sort of thing never really happens. And just make sure you're recording. Make sure you're recording.
Make sure the camera's rolling.
Make sure the camera's rolling. And Christian, bless him, you know, he got covered in champagne after that moment. And, you know, the first thing he did was he came up to me. And imagine what was, and no one will see this, you know, but he came up to me and he said, I'm soaking wet. And I went, okay, let's go and change that radio mic. Let's go and change it. So we ran out of the celebrations. We ran into his office. He stripped off. I gave him a new radio mic. He put that one on and then he went back out.
Wow.
And then he went and celebrated. He went and got on the podium, you know, and of course, after that, it was the protest. You know, there was another huge story that just kept going. So I think that's an example of like the trust, like in that moment. That huge Absolutely. Moment for him, he still was like, he gave me another 3 minutes, you know, he gave me 3 minutes where we protected what we had and we went again, you know. And I just, for me, that's like, I can't ask for more than that.
That's beautiful. You mentioned a few things about, you know, the different angles that you're shooting and how you have to be there, how you have to be rolling for so many different moments across so many different weekends. And I want to actually dive into, you know, your storytelling and what you think tells a story successfully and what are the key elements of compelling storytelling. And, you know, feel free to reference, you know, filmmakers that you've learned from or things that you've learned on your own. But would be so curious to know what you think tells a story successfully.
I think you need rootable characters that have, you know, I mean, at the moment, really what people seem to be after is kind of rootable characters that have high stakes. You know, and I'm always looking for people that have a kind of, you know, an inner struggle as well, you know, an outer struggle and an inner struggle. People that are somehow wrestling with something inside, you know, some contradictions that you can play with. You know, I think most people have a kind of a public persona and then they have a private persona as well, and I think like it's my job to be in the middle of those two,
yeah,
and to be kind of measuring the distance, you know. I think I'm there to illuminate what's there. I'm not there to create a world. I think I'm there to illuminate the world that I see, you know, and to find a kind of some sort of truth in all of it.
So once you find that common thread, though, that truth that you want to follow, how do you know, how do you approach interviewing different people and stitching that that narrative together to sort of pull out that truth? Because you said that you're not creating, you know, a story, you're illuminating what's already there. So how do you go about structuring the story in a way that illuminates that truth? How do you know who to speak to? Is this something that's more intuitive for you? Or is this something that you sort of approach more methodically?
I don't know. I mean, I think it changes, you know, like if I take, I guess, the example of like Breakpoint, like we might go into a season with, you know, some of the characters will have a sense of like what their story is going to be that year. And then some of them will have no idea. And, you know, we've got this character called Isla Tomjanovich, who's a,
yeah,
I think she's 29 year old female tennis player. And, you know, we start the year with her and she's kind of like just about in the top 50. She's like a kind of a journeyman sort of tennis player. And, you know, she's kind of got this tennis player boyfriend who's also a Hugo Boss model. And, you know, she's on the brink of retirement. She's like ready to go, basically. And that's really the start of her year. Like, and I was devastated. I was like, oh, this can't be it for her. Like, we're doing nothing for women's rights here. And, you know, 4 months later, she's beating Serena Williams,
yeah,
at the US Open, you know, and we've got that story. Like, I'm there with her the night before, the morning before, 2 minutes before she plays Serena, she retires Serena, you know. And we couldn't have written that, you know. I couldn't have like written that. I mean, we could have, but, you know, it probably wouldn't have come true. And so I think that, you know, and within her circle of like within her inner circle, you know, her dad is sort of her coach. He's there all the time. She has, you know, another coach with her. So you know that you need to, these people know her the best. They have seen all the highs and the lows and everything she's been through. So you know that they're going to be important in telling her story as well. I think you're always looking for these kind of emotional proxies, you know, people that know your characters best. You can often tell the, you know, the emotional story through them if you kind of can't get it through like the main character themselves. I've just been in Indian Wells. I just got back a few days ago, starting season two of Breakpoint. And like, we don't know what the story is yet. Like, we don't know what it is with these people. So what I try and do is I sit down with all of the main characters for like an hour and a half, like this, basically. And we just do an audio interview, audio only. No cameras, no lights, nothing. We just sit in a, you know, in a hotel room on a nice sofa, microphone comes down, and we just chat. You know, no prepared questions, a few prepared questions, but like, and you know, that interview is really important because it basically will tell us, you know, everything that this person is trying to do this year, you know, and who they're up against and what they're worried about, what they're really worried about. You know, last time she played Roland Garros, she was so scared that she threw up. All right, okay, well, maybe the next time she plays at Roland Garros, it's going to be similar. Maybe that's a Roland Garros story for that character. And I think if you're with them long enough, they reveal like who they really are, the visual treatment of it. It's kind of my, you know, my job to figure out how it should look and figure out how it should feel. And, you know, I always think it's important that the audience feels the environment, feels the what it's really like to be one of these people in some of these spaces. You want to create, you know, these are films, it's a visual medium, it's supposed to be visceral, you know. I think with tennis, you know, it was about trying to almost subvert that romanticized image of tennis that we already know. You know, I think that it has this, rightfully so, right? Like, these players, they're beautiful, they're graceful, they fly through the air, it's, you know, balletic moves. And, you know, but what I saw was just this grind, just this absolute relentless brutality on the body, constantly playing, constantly being treated for something, messy hotel rooms, win or lose, you're on the plane the next day and then you're just starting again at round one. It's like always round one, you know. So to get to some kind of, like, what I think anyway is like the truth of a moment, you know. And I think the truth is like a sliding scale, right? Like, and it's changing as well. Like, it's, you know, there's an energy to what the truth is. It can be many things. You can be seeing, you know, there can be a visual truth and then there can be another truth underneath it. And I think it's our job to be looking at that all the time.
In order to be telling or illuminating the story successfully and getting to those layers, would you say that would be the sign that you've told the story successfully, is if your audience also gets that illuminated version? Because, you know, I'm curious to understand, like, when those first few seasons of Formula One came out, there was a discrepancy between what the drivers thought it was going to look like or the team principals, and then what the audience received and what they felt. So how do you know in those cases that the story has been told successfully, that the right truth has been illuminated?
I think in Formula One, it's always those bits in between that we felt were the kind of the real bits that we wanted. So if you follow someone, what we would often do is follow the characters into other interviews, right? And, you know, but it'd often be the bit on the way to the interview where, you know, they'd be getting briefed by their press officer, say this, say that, don't say this, don't say that. That's the bit we would use, you know, because that's the truth. That's the real bit, you know. And the show actually is almost made up of a lot of those moments, actually, you know. And I think that sport, like, I think we hit something in sport, you know. There's what you get in sport is this kind of presentation of who people are. It's the halftime show, it's the post-match interview, it's three pundits kind of sitting there, and it's the same every single time. And I think we felt as though there's this huge wealth of story and character that no one's really seeing, you know, outside of those 3 minute interviews that they do here, there and everywhere. Of course, that changes, like, when you're there on the ground, like, the story changes, and it should change. Like, you should always be listening and watching and thinking about where it can go and how can it be even more exciting or even more dramatic or even more moving. There are cuts, there are rough cuts, there are fine cuts, there's rough cut one, rough cut two, rough cut six, you know. So there's a huge, you know, these the films on Drive to Survive, I mean, we would open an edit suite, you know. Episode one is like never finished. I mean, it opens, I don't know, when's the season start? March. So we might start cutting that in maybe like halfway through April, early May. We might start episode one. And we'll keep making it. We'll keep making it until December. So episode one will just keep going. Honestly, it never stops.
Because there's so many cuts from different races that go into each episode, right? So is that why episode one never really stops until the end of the season?
One episode has to talk, you know, each episode talks to the one before it.
Yeah.
You know? So you don't want to say something in episode one, in race one, that by race 24 is no longer true. You know, you don't want to come out of the gate with this big idea about the season and then that big idea never actually takes place.
So across Formula One, Breakpoint now, but also your previous films that you've done, they've covered such interesting topics, probably rather dark taboo topics like suicide or homelessness, refugees, death row. The one that struck me the most was the 14-year-old child who shot their own parents. You know, you've you've interviewed so many people across so many different walks of life and have so many different experiences. What are the common themes that you've learned about the human experience across all of these people? What have you drawn from their stories the most?
Bloody hell. I don't know. Big question. I don't know. I think I just sort of admire people that go through adversity, really. I think capacity for people to overcome, to keep going. Yeah, I mean, I'm making another film at the minute about a refugee who kind of gets caught up in the, you know, those ugly civil wars in West Africa in the early 90s. He ends up on a kind of 15 years stuck in a refugee camp. He then gets given resettlement in America, and then that doesn't work out, and he ends up going home and basically rebuilding his entire nation, you know, brick by brick. So I think you're just learning different, you know, and so his capacity for like forgiveness and his ability to move on from that trauma to do something good is amazing, you know. And I think for me, it's like, it's not, you're not learning like one thing, you're like learning something different from all of these experiences. And I guess they, you know, they challenge what you think you already know, you know, about that person or that group of people. And it's, you know, they also challenge what you think you're doing, you know, and other films do that to me as well. I mean, honestly, I saw a film called Retrograde recently. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's Matt Heineman, who's like probably like, you know, one of the best threats at the moment. He's gone and made this film in Afghanistan, and it's, I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, he's there when all of the, you know, the American troops pull out, you know, that day when the last airplanes leave. I guess for me, it's like the films that really affect me, like that's what I'm trying to do, you know, like that's like when you get that feeling when you're watching a film, when there's a denouement that comes along and like rips your guts out, you know, and makes you feel something in that particular moment, like that's the feeling I'm looking for, that's the thing that I'm trying to give, you know, to other people. You're looking to have a moment that just transcends the sport. Isla beating Serena probably gets there, you know. I think there was season 3 of Drive to Survive, there was a film in there called Man on Fire, which was brilliant, you know, where yeah, some driver blew up and someone else like got his career back, and
that was, so you Roman get these... Grosjean, right? That was, yeah, Car on Fire. Yeah,
I mean,
incredible.
Every now and then in that sport, there are these moments that just, they're just levelers, you know, the whole place just goes quiet, and you know, the politics goes out the window, the, you know, who's in front of who, who's, you know, what Lewis is wearing that weekend.
You know, we were discussing how difficult it can be to create a career in media, especially if you don't start off with connections. And I think quite a few people who will be watching this and reading this are into writing and into media and content creation and, you know, that world. So what 3 practical pieces of advice, and feel free to not stick to the 3, or, you know, any advice you'd like to give to someone who is trying to get into filmmaking or making documentaries like you are?
I think, like, don't be scared to reach out to people. Like, you can actually find a lot of people, you know, a lot of contact details online for people that you want to find. And actually, most people are like willing to, you know, have a Zoom call or like have a chat. I think, like, when you first come out of university or college or whatever, you don't really know. I think you have this idealism about what the job is going to be or how you think you're going to get there. And is probably not true, you know. Try and find out about it, find out more about it, talk to people that are practicing filmmakers, practicing professionals, you know, to just understand more. And I think they will give you their time. Just do it. Like, don't be scared. Like, do it when you're young as well. Like, I think there's a timing thing in this industry. You don't want to start too late, you know, because it is going to be a hustle. Like, it's going to be pretty hard early on. It just is. It should be, but it just is. And I don't think you want to be having that hustle if you've got lots of other responsibilities in your life. I don't know, kids, mortgages, you know, yeah, sick parents, whatever, you know, because those are going to be the things that actually pull you away from it. Learn as much as you can and, like, be active. Like, you know, cameras and technology, there's so much of it around these days. Like, I think you can make something on your phone. Like, you can make something with a really cheap camera. It is, like, it is democratized now, and, like, I've benefited massively from technology, you know. Like, when I first got into this, it was DV tapes, you know. It was these small cameras, but that meant I could basically walk around and, like, just make a film, like, about someone on my own. I didn't need anyone else to make a film, really. And I think that remains. Like, be curious. Like, you have to be curious about the world. Like, I think most of these things are just expressions of curiosity, really, for me. I just want to know a bit more about that. Or, oh shit, really, that kid shot his parents in the head, what the hell? I need to know
yeah,
what happened there. Or, you know, oh my god, like, your son is on death row, like, what's that like? Or be active and reach out to people and be curious about the world, ask questions all the
start
time.
Early,
I think, start early,
yeah,
you know. And, like, don't worry about it being a hit or being brilliant. Just have fun with it and study it. Like, just watch good stuff, read good books. There's a book that I got called, it's called Think. And it's interviews with documentary filmmakers, and it's one page of advice from all the best practicing documentary filmmakers. Read that book. You know, I think it's about finding your place within it, which can take some time. Like, I think, you know, I used to be I was a focus puller. You know, I used to do that on films. And then I used to work in the camera department, and I got really bored, you know. And then I didn't study documentary at all at university. I studied feature films, fiction films. That's what I was into.
Oh, wow.
And it was only seeing a documentary on TV, and I was like, holy shit, is that real? Like, that's real. Like, that's real drama. That's better than anything anyone could have written, you know. And I that was it for me. I think it was 22, and I saw that, and I was like, who made that? So I wrote to that production company and said, look, I'll come and make the tea. I'll come and, you know, cut the fruit up in the mornings and just experience. Like, honestly, just experience. Like, all experiences are useful, you know. Like, even if you know, I used to do a lot of cop shows, you know. I used to be that guy that used to jump out of the cop car and film people getting arrested, and, you know, like, I did a lot of that. And
wow.
But actually it made me really good with a camera. It made me really good at, like, getting a story really quickly, and they run into a house and there's a victim and you need to film that, and they need to trust you instantly, and, you know, but you need to get the story, and you know, and it all needs to be in focus and all that kind of stuff. So all of these little these are building blocks. Like, I think this is the thing, like, for me anyway, it's just a process and it's skill, and you get better at it the more you do it.
Speaking of which, though, are there any projects of yours that are coming up that you can talk to, which we can look forward to watching soon? I know you mentioned second season of Breakpoint, and then you mentioned another film that you're working on. But are there any projects we can look forward to in the near future from you?
Well, yeah, so season two of Breakpoint's been commissioned. So I've just started on that. That's why my voice is going, because I've just been... I've just been filming for 12 days.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, in California. We've got some good stuff, actually. I was kind of left this audio like diary from this guy that died. He basically decided to record a series of messages to his grandson. He knew he had this degenerative disease, and he's recorded like 100,000 words worth of almost like directives for life kind of thing. And we recorded them before he died, and I'm kind of thinking about what to do with that. It's a bit sort of Tuesdays with Maury. I don't know if you know that book, like it's pretty amazing. And so I'm thinking about trying to do something with that. I'm talking to this team in America about pickleball at the moment.
Oh my goodness. We actually just did an interview with one of the world champions in pickleball, Simone Zarzing. She actually runs a few camps in Naples, Florida now, but we actually did an article about her a couple months ago. So we're very familiar with pickleball here. We love it.
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be some shows coming out about pickleball. I'm pretty sure about that. So I've had a few inquiries about that kind of thing. I mean, I think the sport thing is like, it's still like an expanding, you know, area of broadcast at the moment.
Yeah.
Just about, like, I think eventually it will contract. Like the company I'm working for at the moment, they've obviously made Drive to Survive, and then from that we've made tennis. There's a golf show called Full Swing.
We've
got the Tour de France that they're doing. There's a rugby show, and I think that there's still a lot of room to, you know, I think some of these American sports are like need a bit of a jab in the arm. You know, so I think
I would love to see a project from you in the future following football in some way, considering it's played such a huge role in your life growing up. I think I'd be really interested to see you follow, you know, a football club one day, or, you know, I don't know if you've watched Wrexham from Ryan Reynolds, but like something like that, or something of your own that you come up with. But I think that'd be really cool.
Yeah. Well, my friend makes... Yeah, the DOP on Drive, we also shoot Wrexham, so I kind of know that project well. It's good, actually. It's kind of has a nice tone to it that I wasn't expecting. But I don't know, I think you kind of want to find a sport that is a bit of a sleeping giant, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
You want to find something that everybody kind of knows it, but that's why Formula One was quite good. It like everybody knew about it. It was that sort of, you'd sit down and watch a little bit with your dad on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, like while he's full asleep, or you used to watch it 10 years ago, but you don't really watch it anymore because it's just those cars going round and round and round, you know, and it's those guys in helmets and you never see their face. And, you know, it kind of worked because you were showing people this completely different side to it. So I think that's when it works really well. And, you know, let's see where it goes. I mean, look, if someone brings me, you know, the Melania access, I'll go and make that Melania Trump film, you know, like I would love
that's
to make
true.
That film.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes
what
sense.
A film that, what a film that would be.
What a film that would be. Know? That would be true. This is something we ask basically anyone we interview, is what does the word success mean to you in like a sentence?
Don't go for success, go for significance.
Wow. What a great note to end on. That's terrific.
Is that cheesy enough for you?
No, not even cheesy. We love the good sound bites here. We love, putting out positive energy, and that's why we always ask that question towards the end, because everybody has such a different outlook on what success means, and we have a lot to learn from everybody's perspective of success. So I've certainly learned a lot from this conversation. I went into it with an expectation of who you might be, and I walked away with a completely different perspective of what it takes to be a great filmmaker, and you certainly are one of those. So really, really appreciate your time here today. Thank you so much, Martin.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
No, not at all.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.